there were all these things you had to do, and it was common to the companies that did well, which was category creation, category redefinition, statistical market validation, value propositions, pricing models. The best companies did that during the go-to-product phase, concurrent with the product engineer. And I thought, you know, what these companies lack, I went on a long walk, it's actually with my daughter, and I was going, I need a term for this. And I go, we need to show people how to engineer a market. And I went, that's it, market engineering. Market engineering, that's the term that defines all of that category creation, definition, validation, et cetera, all under one umbrella term, market engineering. We need to learn how to become market engineers.
Thanks for downloading. This is Christopher Lockhead, Follow Your Different. We're a real dialogue podcast, which is kind of the antidote to the standard interview. And we aim to celebrate the people, ideas, and companies that stand out. We're sponsored by Oracle NetSuite. Learn how to turbocharge the growth of your business today at netsuite.com/different. And there you will be able to set up a free 1-hour growth review with an expert in your industry. Check out netsuite.com/different. On this episode, an entrepreneur, executive, venture capital investor, and now author, my buddy, Bruce Cleveland. And he's got a new book out. It's called Traversing the Traction Gap. And I think this is going to go down as a very important book for startup founders and technology leaders around the world. Bruce has got some amazing insights. And he's really a guy that you want to learn from. As a matter of fact, his firm, Wildcat Ventures, has been rated by kind of third-party independent verification as one of the top 1% of enterprise B2B tech investors on the planet. And we have a conversation that candidly is a masterclass in how to build massively successful B2B enterprise companies. We talk about where most startups fail and what to do about it. Why what Bruce calls market engineering is a critical skill that every executive, founder, and CEO needs, and how you need to build your company and your category to scale. If you're a tech exec, founder, startup founder, or investor, you will gain immediately insights on this episode that I know you'll want to put to work immediately. Check out Lockhead.com for the show notes and key takeaways from this episode, as well as learning more about Bruce's new book and how to get it. Now, hey ho, let's go.
I decided to take the lessons I had learned from great guys like Tom Siebel and Larry Ellison and see if I could apply them, those lessons, into early stage investing. And fortunately, you know, I was able to invest in an idea that became pretty successful called Marketo. It was just three guys and a, you know, I don't know if there was a dog involved, but it was definitely, you know, three guys, John, Dave, and Phil. And we built, you know, some ideas around that. And it turns out their ideas were actually way better than mine, because I actually thought about doing something in terms of transforming the role of marketing from what I had affectionately called party planning into something that would be have equal stature with the chief revenue officer.
Hey, I made a whole career out of that party planning.
Yeah, I know.
I live at the beach because I threw a couple of really good parties. That's probably my new, I'll update my LinkedIn profile.
I thought that that we could actually transform that role. So we, you know, instead of sort of where they go around the room at the exec board meeting and ask each person, hey, you know, what's APAC going to do in revenue? What's, you know, Europe going to do? What's the US going to do? And then they get around to you and you're running marketing, because I had that role at Siebel as well. And they kind of just bypass, you know, kind of go right around you because you're the cost center. I hate that. I don't want to be the cost center. I want to be a revenue center. So how do I do that? And that was kind of the genesis of the idea of how could we transform this role. Turns out that Dave, John, and Phil had an even better idea about how to do it and built a phenomenal company. And it was just acquired a few months ago by Adobe for about $4.8 billion, which is, huge outcome. Great for those guys. It was great to be a part of it and learn from them.
Smart for Adobe too. You know what? I've been critical of some of the things they've done in the past, but I think what they've done over the last, I don't know, plus or minus 10 years or so of doubling down on the CMO, doubling down on marketing, doubling down on creative professionals, and sort of thinking about marketing in a very, best I can tell, very big way. I got to take my hat off to them. The folks at Adobe are doing some very smart shit, including acquiring Marketo.
Yeah, I am. It's funny why others did not acquire Marketo. There's a variety of reasons for that that I won't go into here. But I think Adobe's made a good move on that. I think it's a good landing place for them. Steve Lucas seems like he's at least on the face of it happy. I don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but anyway, company. I think it's a good place for Marketo to have landed. But those lessons, because Oracle was just basically a startup when I joined. It was, not exactly. It was about 15, 20 million in revenue. Stiebel was a couple million in revenue.
I think given where Oracle is today, I think you could call 15 to 20 million the startup years of Oracle.
Yeah. And then on the investment side, being involved with a company like Marketo and others, the lessons that I took from that is that there were some very specific patterns that those CEOs took in engineering their success, and yet I saw a lot of other companies, a lot of startups, not executing that pattern. And over the course of a decade at my prior firm, what I learned from that was you could begin to see which teams were actually have a chance for success and which teams weren't. And so that pattern that emerged, I decided to kind of explore that. And so what emerged out of that was I realized that there were really three phases that every startup goes through. And I would argue that if you're a new product offering inside of a large company, you go through these three same phases. Your venture capital in a large company is your CFO, the CEO, and a few others, right? It's still, they're giving you resources, capital, people to go build something, right? So I think this still applies. The three phases. The first phase is this go-to-product phase. You have an idea. It's informed by hopefully some research. I'll tell you what I've actually found in the in my discovery process about how much non-research occurs. But anyway, the go-to-product phase, right? You reach this first point that you have a prototype or you've got some kind of a working product. You put it into the market somehow, maybe a few customers, you get feedback, and you reach this more polished version called minimum viable product that Steve Blank and Eric Ries have all taught us, right? Okay, that's the go-to-product phase. And it turns out that most of the teams we invest in, Chris, in these early stages, they're very good at product engineering. They come out of the best schools. They worked in the best companies. They've been taught how to do it. They know the tools they need. They know how to build. They know how to spec the product, to create the architecture for it, and then to actually deliver that. So that's something that there's a lot of help with. There's a lot of, Y Combinator, AngelPad, a lot of these incubators and accelerators will help you as a team think about that product phase, right? Okay. I'm going to skip to the third phase, the go-to-scale phase, okay? That's where, hey, you got some customers, things are really working. Now you've converted from being a PowerPoint company, and now you're a spreadsheet company. PowerPoint is how great it's going to be. Spreadsheet is how good was it and how good
is
that.
It? Wait a minute. Could you say that again for me, Bruce?
Yeah. So you start out as a PowerPoint company, and that's in the go-to-product phase. That's how good it's going to be. And the go to scale phase is how good is it?
And those are spreadsheets. That's the difference between PowerPoints and spreadsheets.
That's right. And so
that's why I like the PowerPoint world better, because I like to live in the dreamer pirate world. How big could this thing be?
And what you'll find in the word venture capital is a fairly interesting phrase or term, because I've found that there's not a lot of venture in venture capital. What most firms want to see is this thing called traction. They want to see demonstrable evidence that there's a market and that people will purchase or use your product. And it needs to be enough demonstrable evidence that they're willing to invest in you. And we're going to get to what that is and what those points are. But that go to scale phase, there's a lot of companies that will finance that. And there's a lot of great brands that are out there that wait until you get to that point before they will invest in you.
And I hate to interrupt you, but do you see this? I mean, maybe you don't see it as much, but maybe you do. You'll tell me. But when I talk to entrepreneurs, particularly in the very early stages, the frustration they experience or they tell me about, they verbalize to me, is that a lot of firms that they expected to be willing to invest in the PowerPoint stage really only want to invest deep into the spreadsheet phase.
It's gotten worse. In fact, if you look at the data, over the last couple of years, the 60% of all first rounds into a company were $25 million or more. 80% were $10 million or more. Well, there's only a couple, because of math, because of dilution, that means you have to really value those companies pretty high. And so what you've seen is that the classic seed rounds have gone from 25K to 5 million. They're called seeds.
Yeah.
And the classic A and B rounds have gone a lot higher. And there's a lot of reason for this. A lot of those funds, the great brands that we all know, the Sequoias, the Excels, the Benchmarks, they've raised bigger funds and a lot more of them. Yeah. There's not really a tremendous amount of new GPs that have joined those firms. So they need to put more dollars to work per investment. So they're either over-investing in immature companies, or they're marking these companies up that really don't deserve those valuations in order to ingest that kind of capital. Otherwise, there's too much dilution for the management team.
Yep.
So early stage venture, there's a gap that's emerged in that. There, you know, what we used to think of as classic early stage, there's not really a lot of groups that do that. First Round Capital does that. You know, there's a few that specialize in this area. But the problem is there's no signal. If you're an MBA you got your great degree out of Harvard, which is a phenomenal degree, but you've never personally built a software company, and I'm using software because that's the business I'm in. You've never built a company. What did you learn when you got your MBA? You learned numbers. You learned how to analyze a business. That's what an MBA was for. It's a professional degree to be able to analyze businesses. There's nothing to analyze in these early... knock yourself out in the PowerPoint, dude. You know what I mean?
I have a patented analytical process for evaluating startups. It requires some time with my friend JD and my friend Mary Jane.
Exactly.
Right? So you have a couple of whiskeys and a couple of tokes, and you say, can we believe that this might happen?
Well, you got that exactly right. In fact, I'm going to use that visionary thing in a few minutes. I'm going to relate this back to something else. That's the problem that we have, is that there are very few venture capitalists who have personally either were a member of a founding team or were the founder of a early stage startup that went on to $1 billion plus outcome. Now, it so happens that me and my two partners here at Wildcat, We've done that 15 times. So we have.
That doesn't mean you're experienced.
No. It means we're old. That's what it means.
We had just a bit of a side note. We had David Cancel, the founder of Drift and co-founder of HubSpot, on recently. And I just love the guy. He's just killing it, you know. And we were talking about this. He has this expression. I think he got it from an author, but so you'll excuse me for forgetting the source. But he calls it carrying the water. You got to carry the water. And the point that he made is, you know, the people you really want to learn from are the people that have done it multiple times, right? There's a lot of sort of bullshit wannabe internet social media gurus today who, like, you know, read a Tony Robbins book and watch a Gary Vee video and you start spewing out crap, right?
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. In fact, you're making a good point here. So, and I'll finish up the framework and how this all works and what the gap is all about in a second here. But we only do B2B and B2B2C. And if you take a look at the data from MIT and Northwestern, they did studies about age, right? And you would think because of the great, you know, that you got to be 20. If you're 30 or older, you're washed up in tech. But the truth of the matter is the data sets that were generated, they looked across thousands of companies and successes. For B2B, so and the B2B2C model, the average hyper success comes from people who are 45 to 65 as entrepreneurs. I mean, by a wide margin. And you could do it. There's an interactive application on Northwestern. If you go Google Northwestern age study, you'll get it. And you can enter in the age 55 and put in 30, or, you know, 52 and put in 28, or whatever you want to do. And it will show you the multiple, that is, how much better the odds are if you invest in somebody at that older age than the younger age. And quite frankly, the reason I think it is, I'm just conjecturing, it's that that you have to be a subject matter expert if you're going to do B2B technology. You've got to really if it's database or infrastructure or application at all levels, you just need a lot of expertise in doing that. And it takes a while to build up that expertise. B2C, you know, you could be two guys in a dorm room and do pretty well. You know, I've seen them do it.
The B2C stuff is a little hit by lightning-y, right?
Yeah.
So well, far as, if you look at some of the big B2C successes, you know, take, and I don't mean any disrespect, but you know, take a company like Airbnb. Look, anybody who says they knew that was going to happen has got to be full of shit, right? Because in the beginning, right, you say renting your car, like, it just doesn't seem to on its face. It's hard to imagine that it becomes what it becomes. Now, the beauty of being a young entrepreneur in that situation is, you know, you're young enough and dumb enough to think it's possible. And I think that's a really great attribute for an entrepreneur. But to your point, I think in the B2C space, there's a little bit of getting hit by lightning, particularly maybe with some of the younger guys. In the B2B space, you know, the ecosystem is, as you are a expert in, you know, you got to be able to not just build the company and the category, but you got to build an ecosystem around it. And like, there's just a lot of moving parts to getting an enterprise class B2B company to work.
Yeah. And I think part of the problem that we've seen manifest in the form of governance in these B2C companies is that because when they hit lightning and they are a lot younger, they haven't had an experience of going through and learning all the phases of a large company. So when they now have to build a large company and they're running it, they really haven't seen the movie before. Whereas in the B2B space, most of the people who we are working with have been part of a large company, been part of a large successful company, maybe have done a startup before. So consequently, I think the governance and the issues that they know that the things that they need to solve, I think it's far better understood. So, you know, I take a look at people like Anil Bhusri and Dave Duffield with, they did PeopleSoft and then they did Workday, right? I mean, Workday was just PeopleSoft in the cloud. So they did a phenomenal job. They knew what they needed to build. They were very experienced. And so it's no surprise that Workday has done well. C3, Tom Siebel's new company. It took a little bit of energy to get to where they are now, but now it's a billion and a half valuation off to the races as an AIML platform. And Tom knows how to construct that. I mean, his board is a who's who, you know, of Condoleezza Rice. And I mean, just it's a phenomenal, you would never get that board right. unless you were Tom.
Right. Exactly.
So yeah. So I think it just takes a different set of skills and learning to do B2B. And those B2B executives, startup executives, don't want a 30-year-old who's never done it before on their board. They want somebody who's got their butt kicked, knows what kind of things they have to be concerned with, don't panic when things don't all go right, and are able to draw from their own personal networks to help them staff their company if possible.
Well, and just to put a finer point on it, I recently had a conversation with a very high profile, I guess he's roughly 35-ish, don't know exactly, entrepreneur, built a very successful company, but started off in the freemium consumer space. And over time, and still has some kind of a somewhat of a consumer business, but over time has really morphed into much more of a B2B company. And it's very clear, and he didn't quite use this language with me, but part of why we were meeting was they were trying to figure out what to do next and how to position the company and should they create a new category and do category design. And that, you know, the conversation you'd expect a guy like me to be having with this kind of an entrepreneur. But the interesting thing about it is I could tell in my conversation with him, if I were to talk to a world-class enterprise CEO, which I have the privilege of doing on a fairly regular basis, compared to this guy, this guy doesn't know where the dials and knobs are. He was honest enough to me to say that he sort of doesn't, they have an idea of where to go, but they really don't know how to do it. And I think, frankly, even though he's been incredibly successful, he could buy and sell me a zillion times, having been a sort of a B2C hit by lightning type guy, done very well with it, but now realize the real money's in the enterprise space, really grasping around trying to figure shit out in a way that, you know, if you and I were to talk to many of the world-class enterprise CEOs we know, it's a very different conversation that you're having.
No, I think you're exactly right. I think it's just a different skill set, and because you're going after a different market, et cetera. And one of the things that we find, and so I'll finish up the traction gap framework concept because I talked about the bookends, the go to scale and the go to product. Those aren't the two things that are that kneecap companies. It's that middle phase. It's the second phase. It's the go to market phase that we call the traction gap. That's where 80 to 90% failure rates occur. And I'll tell you, as I actually rewrote this book that comes out in a couple of weeks that I wrote called Traversing the Traction Gap, I actually rewrote the first four chapters. I wanted a term, you know, there's like only a few takeaways that you remember out of any of these business books, right? You know, if somebody reads your book a year later, they're going to remember two or three things, right? That's what they remember. That's all. Same with Jeffrey Moore's book. One of my partners wrote Crossing the Chasm and a bunch of other books.
Crossing the Chasm, one of the greatest business books of all time. And I think, I don't actually know Jeffrey, but I think he made an incalculable contribution to not just the Silicon Valley world, but really the business world with his book. And not to say that some of his other books haven't been incredibly important, because I think they have. But Crossing the Chasm, whew, that's a set of thinking that has made a giant difference to, you know, probably tens of thousands of entrepreneurs.
No, I agree. It's more than 2 million copies have been sold. And I would presume read. It's still on the list of a lot of the top universities. Jeff is Mark Benioff's strategic advisor. So he's wonderful to have here as part of our firm. Because he complements, he's a great thinker about problems, and he works with our teams to help them go through these issues. And I'll explain exactly what those issues are. So I looked at this framework. I said, okay, there's these three phases: go to product, go to market, go to scale. Your job, whether you choose to accept it or not, as an entrepreneur, is you have to reach these different value inflection points as you move through your journey. And the those value, it turns out that they are, they have a set of metrics, et cetera, attached to each one of them. And the reason you want to hit them is because it dramatically increases the value, a step function, the value of your company. It diminishes risk, and therefore investors are interested. So if you take Jeff's chasm, that's about looking outward at markets, visionaries, mass market, right? The early majority, right? He created vernacular that we could then think about, oh, this is the persona of that particular market that I want to go after. The book I've written and this traction gap framework, though, is looks at the world a little differently. They're complementary. And the traction gap framework is designed to help teams think about capital and investors, because your job early on is to create interest, awareness and interest from investors to help you go on to scale. So in the early days, this is one of the most important things you can do. In fact, out of the book, I said, you know, there's two products you really have to build. You have to build a product for the market that you're selling out to, what consumer good or a, you know, hardware product or a SaaS offering. But there's another product you have to build, and it's a financial product. You need to realize that you have to speak differently and present differently when you go talk to investors. And you have to be able to create something that's of interest, and that of interest is really traction. And without traction, you're not going to get interest from the venture community by and large. In that, I wanted to come up with, I realized that there was this pattern, right? And I started by saying, I rewrote the first four chapters because I was searching for a Mark Benioff, no software kind of concept. I love the fact that, you know, it's brilliant. At the time, I didn't think it was so brilliant, but it's amazing. Instead of talking about multi-tenancy and all these complex, you know, computer science terms, he basically just, in one instant iconic diagram, showed us all, this is the crappy world that you live in, called this enterprise software stuff filled with bloat and shelfware. And here's what we're doing, which is easy to install. We run it. You pay by the, you know, you pay as a utility. And so, but Mark was brilliant about how he marketed that. And I was searching for that because I realized I had a lot of, it wasn't a lot of complexity in the framework, but I wanted a way to create a term for what I was talking about. So what I found and what I discovered in all our interviews, we did like 60 of these, and then in writing it, was that there were all these things you had to do and it was common to the companies that did well, which was category creation, category redefinition, statistical market validation, value propositions, pricing models. The best companies did that during the go-to-product phase, concurrent with the product engineer. And I thought, you know, what these companies lack, I went on a long walk. It's actually with my daughter. And I was going, I need a term for this. And I go, we need to show people how to engineer a market. And I went, that's it. Market engineering. Market engineering. That's the term that defines all of that category creation, definition, validation, et cetera, all under one umbrella term, market engineering. We need to learn how to become market engineers. Tom Siebel's a market engineer. Mark Benioff's a market engineer. Larry Ellison, market engineer. They had this innate talent. They knew they needed to do it. They knew how to do it, and they did it well. It's not that I think this is beyond the grasp of all the teams that we work with. It's just that they don't know they need to do it. They think they wait till this magical point called MVP. Then they start that stuff. They burn through a ton of capital, make very little progress, and then wonder why it is that they can't get financed. And so one of the big learnings in this, and one of the big things that I counsel in this book, is that teams need to do product engineering and market engineering concurrently. They need to, before they can declare MVP, they must perform the tasks associated with both of those exercises before they actually go to, really start to begin to go to market. And that is one of the, you know, one of those epiphanies, you know, that you get out of even, you know, even amazed me. I went, that's it. That's the magic term that I've been looking for. And if you take anything away from this book, and if I can have, you know, even a tenth the impact that Jeff had, I want to teach people how to become market engineers. I hope that they learn. They may not be great at it initially, but the fact that you know you need to do this, and it is common to the most successful companies that you've ever heard of, you realize that the facts support the outcomes. And if you want to build a global market leading company that is the category leader in its particular category, you must perform these market engineering tasks.
Amen. Hallelujah, brother. You know, and I don't mean any disrespect to, you know, any of the big colleges or universities or any of that, but there is this sort of unquestioned belief, and it's such a strong belief that no one even fucking questions it. Like, no one questions the availability of oxygen. That, hey, I go to this top tier school, I learn to write an algorithm, I take that algorithm and build it into a carbodingulator, that is to say a product, and then I put that product up on my website, I do some tweets or whatever, maybe I do a snap, and then, you know, the world will automatically fall in love with the awesomeness of my carbodingulator, and bam, I'll be Google, right? And it's like, well, maybe, but probably fucking not. The legendary entrepreneurs that you and I have worked with and that you and I have studied have done that step in between, right? You don't get quote unquote MVP and then go bam scale. That's where, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in venture goes up the fucking chimney, right?
Yep.
You've got to be the person that teaches the world how to think about things the way you do, and the world has to agree with you. And when they do, then you, to use your phrase, you've engineered a market. You know, it's exactly the same way I think about category design. It's the same principle, right?
That's right.
You are designing the way a new space, you're engineering the way a new space should work. And if you're that author of that design, if you're the engineer of the thinking around problems and solutions that you're trying to grapple with, then you automatically become, I'm going to use this phrase on purpose, positioned as the leader. And if you're positioned as the leader, then the world marches to your drum. As opposed to what everybody fucking does, which is they ignore the market, they ignore that there needs to be a category, and they think the world will just figure it out because of the awesome-tasticness of their carbodingulator.
Yeah, no, yeah, I think you just described it well. That is the thing that kills almost all these companies, is lack of market engineering skills. And I don't mean passing this off to a marketer. I don't mean it's for the PR group. This is the management, the CEO and the management team must become market engineers. And making those joint sales calls as a team, learning as a team, coming back, because the engineering of the market is going to be done through different listening devices. Those devices are the brains of those different people. An engineer is going to hear something different than the marketer, who's going to hear something different than maybe the CEO, or maybe different than the, you know, than maybe the marketer who's joined your company. But all of those people need to play an active role in listening to what's going on. Maybe somebody can pay attention to the fact that, hey, when we demonstrated this, it didn't come across well. The body language didn't work. Or this particular explanation in the PowerPoint presentation, it didn't go over. We need to change that. The script needs to change. When we talked about pricing, somebody frowned. You know, all that stuff. We're gonna hear different signals in that meeting, and we need to do it as a management team, because the worst thing that you can possibly do is to bolt in that huge carburetor called sales and marketing onto an engine where only a couple of the cylinders are firing. Now you're throwing a ton of gas into there, capital. It blows right out the exhaust pipe, not being burned, not generating horsepower being revenue growth or usage growth or whatever. You need to do all that learning before you go into the market. And that is a fundamental issue with these startups. And that's what I focus on in this book, is this market engineering work, because now here comes the next piece that you helped me develop which is this concept of becoming market first. So this is a thought leadership term. So I'm gonna go on a sort of a tangent here. I was talking with my companies, and he went out and he tried market first. Okay, and so this company you're well familiar with, and was getting nowhere. And say, people don't get it, Bruce. You know, we can't use this. And I started talking, and I came back, and actually this took me, my best stuff is always written in about 15 minutes, because I already know what, I know exactly what the problem is. So I said, you know, the problem is that you're using the wrong talk track. There's three talk tracks you need. The first one is a thought leadership talk track. Thought leadership talk tracks are used in books. They're new language, new terms, new concepts, and you write them, or you speak at keynotes, or you fireside chats. That's where you get the opportunity to introduce new language, your concepts, your vision. Sales engagement, which is what he was doing, that's a different talk track. That's feature, function, benefits. People don't give a darn about your global transformation shit. All they care about is, hey, does your thing, whatever that thing is, does it solve my problem? And there's a third talk track called the investor talk track, which includes a couple of those. Where people go wrong is when they try to use a sales talk track at a thought leadership event. No one's there to buy anything. They're there to learn something. So teach them something and don't try to sell them anything. You get that chance later. They'll come back to you and say, wow, that was really impressive. I'd like to invite you to my company and let's talk about the products that you're offering. If you try to use thought leadership terms in that sales meeting, it's going to go nowhere. So when you talk about becoming market first, which is a big thing in my book as well, which is it's an objective. It's a visionary goal for when you do all this market engineering work right. Someday, that may be an accepted and understood industry term, but it's going to take a while before that's adopted by the industry. So no, and on your website, you may sprinkle some of that stardust into it, but SEM and SEO are not going to help you because no one's searching for market first. You know? Right. That's not what they're looking for. They're looking for, I got this freaking problem and who can solve it for me. So this concept of three talk tracks and developing those, so that way you know which one to use. And when, and in the investor, when you have to add a little bit extra of financial, you got to add some financial in there. You cannot take your sales deck to me as a venture investor, pitch me a product, and at the end go, I need, you know, I don't, whatever you need. I look at it, okay, well, there's a whole lot of other things you got to talk about.
Questions.
Yeah. So,
well, yeah. And you know, it's interesting that you've delineated it this way, Bruce, because, over many, many years, this is a challenge I've had, right? You create the category design, this thing we call the point of view, the POV is how you express it, right? Where you frame a problem and sort of evangelize that problem and then obviously position the solution. And to your point, the POV is the conversation you have at a keynote, at a fireside chat, with the press when you're talking about the future of whatever the space is you're in, right? And then the specifics of how you do it are probably, you know, 20% of the conversation, and the vision and the strategy and the problem and why this matters and why I should care. And, you know, to quote the Big Lebowski, this aggression will not stand, man. We got to get behind this thing, right? That's probably 80% of the conversation, and then 20% of the specifics and maybe a little bit about how and so forth and so on. And to your point, people have a hard time understanding that when you're in this stage of company growth, when you go out and you talk to prospects, you got to invert that. I still believe you need 20% of that strategic category, POV, market vision discussion, because you want to frame the conversation around the specifics that you're going to talk to. So you at least got to have 2 to 3 slides, maybe 4 slides at the beginning with the 30,000 foot. And then great, strap on the scuba gear and have the specific conversations, feature, functionality, benefit, etc. And then, yeah, to your point, you know, the investor conversations probably, you tell me, about 50-50, half vision, strategy, POV, half our products and how we're going to get there, with, again, the focus on, you know, some of the, to your point, the spreadsheet validation around the, you know, can we actually scale this thing? But what I love about what you're doing is teaching entrepreneurs to take one giant, if you will, conversation and be able to tailor that conversation by use case, depending on who the audience is.
That's right. Yeah. The way that I redact the thought leadership thing down is to the epic story. How are you going to transform the world from the way it currently is to the way that you think it could be, right? You need your epic story. And to your point, a keynote is a long epic story, and a sales conversation is a short one. You do need to introduce some of the vernacular, but you quickly have to move into, here's how this will solve your problem, or how we can solve your problem. And you're right, investors will tolerate a little bit more of the thought, a little bit more of the epic story. And in fact, I argue you need that. I mean, I think one of the problems that I find is that most don't have an epic story. Most don't have, they go right into sales talk track, feature, function, benefit. And I said, no, if you want to be a global market leader, you need to become a thought leader. People need to, they have to join your religion. You know, they have to want to come to your church and pray at your stuff. Maybe that's a terrible, I don't know if that's politically correct.
Well, it's probably not, but one of the ones I always like is like, hey, if you want to sell Bibles, there needs to be Christians.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So you're like showing up as a Bible manufacturing company and you're sitting there going, hey, you realize nobody even understands Christianity, you dummy.
Exactly. You know, maybe the thing that'll resonate with others is, hey, if you have a great club, you know, you want people coming to your club. You don't want people to go in someone else. The Category King has their own club. You're trying to create another club that you want the party goers to go to. So you got to have some reasons for them to come. And,
you know,
and
the other thing, just as a side note, that I think, all kidding aside, I think there's more and more proof that the great people want to work for companies that are on a great mission.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my friend Christian Sarkar, who is a classic Renaissance man, and he's the editor in chief of the Marketing Journal, amongst many other things, you know, he talks about brand activism and that it's not enough today for companies to just have a for-profit motive, mm-hmm. right? That companies need to be active on something. They need to take a stand for something. Or, you know, if you think about a gal like Nancy Fund, you know, this concept of a double bottom line, that companies should be equally caring about financial outcomes as well as kind of social or outcomes that impact the world. And so, however you want to think about it, there is an interesting thing that says the legendary companies are on a mission. They are, if you will, creating a religion. And that's good for business, because when people subscribe to your mission, your vision, your religion, then they're going to buy your product. And it also turns out, if you look at it from purely a heart point of view, all of us want to feel like we're doing something that matters. We're contributing. And sure, we need to, you know, make money, and we want to be successful, and long live capitalism. But at the same time, for I think many of us, just making money isn't enough. We also want to feel like we're making a difference. And so the interesting thing about the architecture you're putting together here is you're really helping entrepreneurs tap into this kind of mission-based approach so that they can do market engineering. That is to say, have the world get their vision, their mission, their raison d'etre, the problem they're trying to solve, and use that not only A, to pull on heartstrings in an authentic way, hopefully, but B, to be the company, to be the person that engineers the way a category works for decades to come.
No, I think you're exactly right. There's four architectural pillars that gird this this traction gap framework. They're product, revenue, team, and systems. And when we went and interviewed all, it was really interesting, because when we interviewed the maybe 60 CEOs for the book, we weren't looking for their series seed A, B, C, right? We weren't looking for that kind of those time points. We were looking for value inflection points in the company. And we knew there was no documentation for any of that, because one, this terminology like minimum viable repeatability, minimum viable traction, minimum viable category, which I developed from you, those didn't exist, right? But it turns out that every one of these CEOs, when I explain, well, what's minimum viable repeatability? Well, you've built the product multiple times and released it. You've sold it multiple times. You've hired multiple people. You have now the systems in place to support scale. Do you remember when that came together, when it was kind of your aha moment where, oh, I know if I put X amount of dollars into the top of the funnel, Y is going to come out of the bottom of the funnel, and I can look at my conversion rates. I'm becoming that that spreadsheet company. I literally had that conversation with Phil Fernandez here in this, where we're filming this. And I asked, I said, he goes, well, what do you mean by MVR? And I explained, well, this is what he, and I said, do you remember when that was? And he points out the window right behind me. And he said, you see that building over there, Visa? He goes, I knew it. When we closed that deal, we were at MVR. So there's a visceral thing. And it's a cultural thing that's in the company, that when you talk about the, you know, sort of these CEOs about what they wanted, what the brand identity was, a lot of them have a vision for that. In fact, the best ones in these interviews said, on day one, we set culture. Day one, culture. We established a culture. What would be tolerable? What would be intolerable? You know, what we stood for. We had a vision for what our company could be and what it would be and what we would stand for. Was it okay to come in at 10 a.m. and leave at, you know, 2 p.m.? Or do we come in at 6 and we work until midnight? You know, there's culture, and the team needs to set that from the very get-go. And what you're talking about, and I think it's absolutely right on, it's not just about, well, how much EBITDA am I going to generate, you know, for this company? It's, okay, how are we going to transform the world? How are we going to make the world a better place? How are we going to make it easier if it's a consumer product, easier for a consumer to do something? Or if it's a business product, how can I help their company achieve something? And can I feel good about, you know, am I a polluter? You know, am I a taker or am I a contributor? Am I doing something that in the end I will have created something far better, a far better way for the world to operate and to live and to work? And I think you're right. I mean, I think this is an important part for millennials. I think it's fundamental. And I think that if you don't have, it's one thing to, and I write about this in the book, you can write all this down. I mean, you can write this on a piece of paper about what your culture is going to be. It's a bunch of pablum unless you really live it. You have to actually do what you say your culture is. Otherwise, you're just worshiping at some false god that, and everybody looks around and go, no, that's not what we
not
do.
So much.
Yeah. You don't want that.
Well, and the other interesting thing you're saying, we recently had Professor Maggie Neal from Stanford on. And in this domain, she connected a dot or set of dots here that I'd never thought about in the way that she explained it to me. Her areas of expertise are negotiation, teams, and diversity. And at first I thought, well, that's interesting, but why are those things connected? And what she explained to me, Bruce, is that if you look at a team, legendary teams can tolerate, if you will, a lot of dissension, a lot of, if you will, diversity of ideas and thinking and tough negotiation with each other, a lot of push and pull and so forth and so on, when there's a clear shared vision, mission, and values. Because what she said is, if you and I are completely aligned, we're going to start this software company, and this is the problem we want to solve, and this is the difference in the world that we want to make, and we are going to crawl through flaming grass or glass or whatever to get there. Then, if you and I develop our relationship in such a way that you believe that I'm committed to the cause, and I believe you're committed to the cause, and the rest of the team feels, you know, there's a real sort of connection that way, then when you and I disagree, or when you and I negotiate, you want to do this, I want to do that, and we're sort of pushing on each other, we can, if you will, tolerate a lot of dissension, debate, and discussion because you know that I'm committed to the same thing that you are and vice versa. And while that may sound like a no-shit Sherlock, she kind of laid that out for me in a way that made me go, oh, that's why, quote, diversity works, and not just diversity you know, male, female, different colors, different race, you know, there's that diversity, but diversity of ideas and thinking are embraced when there's shared mission, vision, and values against a set of goals. And when they're not, that is to say, if you and I aren't aligned on those things and then we disagree, well, we're going to call each other assholes and we're going to, you know, we're going to, the team will not, will break apart because we're not focused on the same commitment, goals, and outcomes.
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, in fact, right now, the way in the book, if I were to redo actually the graphic around product, revenue, team, and systems, right now there are four squares, you know, with some icons in them. If I were to redraw them, I actually think, based upon all the interviews and all and my personal experience, is that I put team in the center, big team, revenue, systems, and product around the outside. Team, by far, from every CEO we talked to, was the fundamental issue of whether the company became successful or whether or it failed. Toxic team members, people who couldn't scale, CEOs who didn't want to let a loyal person go because that person was loyal. The team issue becomes fundamental because we're not, most of the things I do are not, they're not manufacturing companies. You know, it's not a, well, they are from the standpoint of, you know, the product line or the assembly line are humans. But at the net of it, it's not machines, et cetera. It's people. And this human factor, it plays a very central role in these companies. And by not establishing that shared vision up front, sharing that vision, explaining how we're getting closer to that vision, by not being, and I agree with also the dissension, being able to feel free to say, I don't agree with that pathway to get to that's okay. And you're right, because if everybody agrees that we're all on the same team, we're coming from a good place, right? We want the same thing. We want the same outcome, but I may think that the path to that outcome is a different pathway. Then you can have that debate. You know, hopefully it's not like the debate I have with my wife in the car about what direction we should go. But you know, but more or less, you know, I think that having that shared vision up front, and then communicating those shared values, that corporate culture, from the very beginning, again, with every CEO, every founding person that we spoke with to write this book, and then in my own personal experiences, reflect that team is fundamental to whether your company is going to survive and thrive.
You know, on that one, there's been something I've been thinking a lot about lately. And so I'm curious to get your reaction. I've not heard this talked about, which is the best executive teams, founding teams that I've seen, they get all up in each other's business all the time. That is to say, you know, the head of sales is meeting with marketing people and the head of marketing is meeting with engineering people. And, you know, the finance folks are out in the field doing customer calls. And they're like, and this has been true of the few great companies that I've been involved with, where there was none of this sort of fiefdom bullshit going on. Like, we were all in each other's shit all the time, not in a disruptive way, but in a, this is our business. Like I'm sure you felt the same way. As a CMO, I never thought the number was the sales guy's number. No, the number's our number, right?
Exactly. Like, if
we don't hit the number this quarter, bad shit happens, right? So I know as the marketing guy, you're supposed to be sort of more forward-leaning and thinking a few quarters ahead and maybe a little more strategic. And maybe the sales leader, maybe she's a little bit more tactical in the current quarter. I get all that stuff. But the truth is, legendary leaders are both worried about the quarter and worried about the future, even if some are more focused on one than the other. But the bottom line is, we're all in each other's shit. I'm sure you had this, you know, if you think about investor relations as an example, you know, there's some CFOs who protect that real tight. Well, in my CMO career, the head of investor relations was as closely tied to me as the CFO, because that's a critical communication, critical part of building a business, and marketing should, in my opinion, be deeply involved. And if you're a great marketing organization, then a great finance and IR organization is going to gravitate to you. Same thing with HR and internal communications and on and on and on. And so this leads me to a question, which is, do you see this as a pattern, Bruce, where legendary teams are kind of intermingled with each other's functional responsibilities?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've actually, you know, and I can't speak to Oracle now. I can speak to Oracle when I was there, you know, back in the 80s. So there's a case where, you know, they were very siloed, right? I mean, there wasn't a lot of cooperation between the marketing organization and, you know, engineering, et cetera. I mean, and as the company got bigger and bigger, there were power groups, right? There were groups that wanted to control the company. And I see this in other companies as well, the larger companies, where they're more worried about what's going on inside and not worried enough about what's going on outside, because what's going on inside could change their power. And so that's where you get these political companies, right? Now, compare and contrast that against, for example, Siebel Systems. Tom wouldn't tolerate any of that. We all knew there was a shared mission. We all knew that if the head of sales and the sales organization didn't succeed, we didn't succeed, the stock price would, you know, get tanked. So no one wanted anybody else's job, at least not on the executive team. We all knew we had a job to do, and we knew it was our job to work as a team. I think the best leaders fostered that kind of environment. But I don't see that shared across a lot of, you know, what we would all consider kind of large incumbents. I see a lot more territory management. And I think everything is the CEO's fault, as far as I'm concerned. They set the tone of the company. And so they can either fix that or let it continue. And I don't see enough leaders, you know, fixing that by basically letting everybody know the stock price is a function of the sum of all of the individual components inside the company.
Yeah. There's no scenario where, the Marines win the war and the Army doesn't.
Yeah, no, right? Exactly.
It's like, well, the infantry fucked up, but the Marines were awesome. No, we either won the war or we didn't, right? But it's amazing how confused people can get inside companies about that, particularly, as you say, as they get bigger.
Yeah, I think it's become increasingly more important, especially as we have people who want more than just the financial return. They want to feel like when they show up in the company, they have a voice. They know that they may not be the final decision maker on things, but they want to feel like they're heard. I think that's what that diversity and inclusion means. It really means that I want an opportunity to participate in a community. In this case, the community is the business. And I want to feel like I'm respected as a respected member of that community. And when you don't let other people speak, you make them feel isolated. And in this world, in our world, we want the best talent. We want the best people. They leave. You know, they go away because they feel like they're not being. Again, you can go overboard, right? It's not a social club. You know, we have to accomplish things, and there are people who need to make decisions, and sometimes those decisions won't align with what you think, but that person will either succeed or fail, usually a manager, director, VP, if they make bad decisions.
Yes.
So I may take it a different direction. I'm with you. I don't really look at these classic definitions of you know, male, female, whatever. I just want the best people, and the best people come from all different things, you know? So, and you need to let them provide input. Otherwise, you're not getting the benefit of that person. You're getting a very slice, yes, of small slice of it. And that's insane. You know, then why did you hire that person? Why is that person a member of the organization? So that's what I see. And I think if we can have more companies understand that a part of that market engineering involves the cultural engineering of the company internally, it'll manifest in the form of the brand. And that brand will then have social implications along with financial implications. And both of those things together can make you a global market leader, because your customers will want to associate with your brand because they believe in the mission, and they believe how you operate as a, you know, as a company in the world ecosystem.
Amen. Hallelujah. Anything else you want people to know about market engineering, Bruce?
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, so we started out this conversation around sort of key takeaways. What will you remember, you know, a year after you read this book? I think, you know, for me, I think I hope people walk away with it, understanding that they need, if they're not good at market engineering, and I lay all this stuff out, that they should find people who can help them. That's that diversity and inclusion part. Find people who can be their wing person, who can, if you're a technical CEO and this stuff is kind of foreign, find, partner with somebody where they can help with all of this work. It's going to turn out to be, I know this is hard. It's hard for all of the technologists out there to get it, but having a great product is table stakes. Having a great company relies upon these market engineering elements. And if you got to have both of those in place, and I provide a prescriptive how-to playbook for you to engineer those things. I show tips and tricks, what others have done. It's all a bespoke journey. You know, there is no one, you know, and if you did everything that I said in the book, that's no guarantee that you will be successful. But if you don't follow these principles that we lay out, that others have used, so it's built on tried, tested, and proven techniques that others have implemented, I'm fairly confident you'll compromise your success. And we want startups to be successful. We don't want these 80-85% failure rates. It's a terrible waste of human capital, GDP. You know, it's just we need a better outcome rate. And I think if people become better market engineers, they become a market first company, I think that they will find a much greater chance of success by following them.
Amen. Hallelujah. All right, Dr. Cleveland, anything else before we wrap?
No, it's great talking with you, Chris. Really appreciate it all. I'm going to finally got our first copies of the book. They'll be available on Feb 21. And
I can't wait to get mine autographed.
Absolutely. It's on its way.
Well, I just want to thank you for writing this book, Bruce. You know, I think it's really great that a guy like you, who's been to the real wars, who's had, you know, to the David Cancel comment, who has carried the water and had success multiple times. I think it's important that you write this shit down and you share the patterns that you see. And I also think it's really important, particularly in our industry, where so many people believe, like they believe in gravity, that the best product wins. And, you know, every time I say that, people think, oh, you don't give a shit about products. I do give a shit about products. I love products, of course. And I know you do, too.
Yeah.
But the reality is many legendary products, many legendary companies die because they don't scale the traction gap, and they don't do that market engineering to teach the world how to think differently. And so the fact that you've been willing to invest more time than I know you expected to.
Yes.
Writing this legendary book is an awesome contribution to the Valley. So, and frankly, to startups around the world. So thank you, Bruce.
You bet. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Talk to you soon.
All right, man.
Whew. Bruce Cleveland. I think a lot of people are going to want to listen to that more than one time. I sure hope you enjoyed that episode or that conversation as much as I did. Now, are you building a high-growth company? If you are, then you need a platform that can take you from the garage to the IPO and beyond. And that, my friends, is NetSuite from Oracle. They're our founding sponsor for a reason. NetSuite pioneered the cloud computing revolution and really established the world's first company dedicated to delivering business applications across the internet. Today, NetSuite provides a full suite of cloud-based financial and enterprise resource planning, or ERP, business solutions for entrepreneurial businesses. NetSuite also delivers legendary omni-channel commerce software. And NetSuite is really the platform for more than 16,000 companies in more than 200 countries and territories around the world. They're frankly the category king in this whole area of cloud ERP. And so NetSuite is the platform that you want to build your business on. And that's why we're so stoked to have them. Now, as a listener to this podcast, they are offering you a great opportunity to have a one-hour growth review with an expert in your industry. So visit netsuite.com/different, and there you'll be able to set yourself up to get that growth review going and talk about the opportunities and challenges and how you break through your growth at netsuite.com/different. And if you want to find us, the first place to look is lockhead.com, LOCHHEAD.com. And even if you subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or Player FM or wherever you may be listening to us, whatever app you may be listening to us on, we don't know you're there. So if you want us to know you're there, the only way we do that or the only way we can do that is if you go to lockhead.com and subscribe, and we will keep you up to date with what's going on with the podcast and various other shenanigans. If you want to send email, blackhole@lockhead.com. We're going to try and do some more Q&A episodes. So blackhole@lockhead.com. We have a Facebook group. I'm on Twitter @Lockhead, on Instagram @Lockhead. And I think that's about it. All right. We would like to thank the amazing new book by our friend and today's guest, Bruce Cleveland, Traversing the Traction Gap. Why not pick up a couple hundred copies today? The Mission Daily Podcast. This is a podcast for smart people who want to get smarter. Check them out. The Mission Daily Podcast. Amazon number one bestseller, Niche Down by Heather Clancy and myself. How to Become Legendary by Being Different. OneLifeFullyLived.org. This is the nonprofit helping you dream, plan, and live your best life. Check out OneLifeFullyLived.org today. Now, if you're starting or running a high-growth business, check out GrowWire.com. This is the new place on the internet for entrepreneurs who want stories of innovation. Check out GrowWire.com. There's also a great podcast. There's a great YouTube channel and much more. Now, if you're starting a business or you're running a business, you may need some help. None of us can do it alone. Why not consider the power of a virtual assistant with our friends at bottleneck.online, where you can get set up with the power of a virtual assistant today. Check out bottleneck.online. The official coffee of this podcast is none other than the amazing Verve Coffee. These folks are the leaders in this new, some people call it third wave of coffee, craft coffee here on the West Coast. And there's nothing quite like it. Check out Verve Coffee in Santa Cruz, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Tokyo, and always online at vervecoffee.com. Now, you may be in Australia. We have a lot of growing listeners in Australia. And if you want to do legendary marketing in Australia, I got the answer for you. That's our good friends at Rapid Media. They are a powerful integrated marketing agency that will help make a giant difference in your business. Check out rapidmedia.com.au. And speaking of other places than the excited states, if you want to do legendary marketing in the UK and Europe, check out the good friends, my good people and good friends at positivemarketing.com. And one of my favorite charities, Habitat for Humanity. Habitat's vision is a world where everyone has a decent place to live. And man, don't we all need that. Please check out habitat.org today. All right, I need to remind you that this podcast is the sole property of the Lockhead Oz Podcast Network. And we'd love it if you shared the shit out of it just a little every once in a while. We must reprimand you. We must reprimand you. Somebody needs to reprimand me that all rights do remain perturbed. And this podcast is clearly produced in a studio that does contain nuts and typically goes better with libations. Remember to teach kids how to start companies, support your local entrepreneurs, and be a podcast legend. Tell two people you love about two podcasts you love. And the folks at Apple just made this a little bit easier. If you're an Apple user, an Apple iPhone user, that is, and you have Siri enabled, you can just look at your phone and say, "Hey, Siri, Subscribe to Christopher Lockhead, Follow Your Different, and bam, she'll do it for you. And so if you have podcasts you want to turn people onto, you know, in the past, it was hard to do that. With Siri enabled, you can just do that with people. Don't forget to buy John's Crazy Socks. Thank you, Dandy Candy. I love you, Mom and Dad. And hey, Colin, this oddcast really ties the room together, doesn't it? Today, our deepest apologies go out to Richard Kelly, chairman of PG&E. Sorry, Dick, we just ran out of time for you. That's it, my friends. Thank you so much. Very cool of you to hang out. And I look forward to seeing you again soon on Follow Your Different.